Hey, Dr. Shear, patient in room 12 is seizing. He just came in from EMS.
Why don't we go get a sugar? All right. And is there another nurse available to pull some Versed? We'll get 4 milligrams.
Okay.
Does the patient have IV access?
No, he doesn't have an IV access. I'll get somebody to start that.
Okay. But for the meantime, we can do 4 milligrams of Versed IM.
IM.
Intramuscular.
Okay, so 4 milligrams of Versed IM.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's roll him to the side. Let's make sure we suction him.
Let's get a non-rebreather on him, please.
Okay.
So just another seizure patient, right? You see these all the time. Give him a little benzo, they stop seizing. But he's not stopping seizing. They're going to their second line agent. Do you know what their third line agent should be? What about their fourth line agent? Do you know what your differential diagnosis is of intractable seizures? Or the definition of status epilepticus and what that means for you clinically? What are you going to do? Are you a tad stressed? Good! Because that'll help the learning.
You know, Stuart, one of the things that I always found really intimidating when I was an intern and early on in my training is the patient seizing.
That's Jess Mason, faculty at UCSF Fresno, but we say Fres yes.
Fres yes!
Talking to the swad that is Stuart.
The patient who comes in with seizures, because I feel like if you don't already have an approach in your mind of exactly what you're going to do, it is pretty scary. So I think for this episode of C3, let's focus on seizures.
Today, we got a lot on our agenda.
We got a lot to do.
We want to talk about a little bit about the terminology, but really focus in on the important things. How you approach a patient that's seizing, that's obviously something you want to cover. And then a little bit about, once you do stop the seizure, a little bit about how you approach the patient in terms of what the cause of it was and where to go from there.
Oh, but there's more. Then we're going to do status, right? The overall approach to status. And then we're going to talk about, there's a few categories, right? You can't just put everyone into the same group here. So there's seizures in patients who have epilepsy. And that's a different ball of wax than someone who's having the first episode of a seizure in their entire life.
I guess you're right. And then you've got to really think about seizures in people that are pregnant differently.
Yes.
In HIV patients and alcoholics after trauma.
Yes.
So you're right. So we have to sort of talk about seizures in the clinical context in which the seizure occurs, obviously. Yeah.
Right. Okay, great. So before we get into all that goodness, let's just do a little bit of terminology. We'll get it out of the way fast. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. We'll just get it over with and just clarify some confusing terminology. Okay, so seizure. What is a seizure? What's the definition of a seizure?
Seizure basically is anything neurologic, any symptom, anything that's neurologic at all that's caused by abnormal electrical firing of neurons. Where people get confused is they mix up the term seizure and convulsions.
Right.
Convulsions are actually the motor manifestations of a seizure. That's the rhythmic moving that you have. And epilepsy is something a little bit different altogether, which is basically a seizure disorder that doesn't have an obvious structural or metabolic cause. It's seizures, just seizures that people have for no obvious reason. And that's actually pretty common. It affects as many as 1 in 100 people in the world.
Okay, so that makes sense. We got seizures, the abnormal electrical activity, convulsions or the motor movements, and then epilepsy is just the primary seizure disorder. Now, I always got bogged down and confused, and I still do about seizure terminology. It's confusing. There's a lot of different names for different types of seizures. So just walk me through generalized versus the partial and the focal. Break it down for me, Stuart. Make it simple.
I think people focus too much on this because in med school, we're used to being presented with these big tables that have all the types of seizures on one side and all the different features. And it makes it sound like we have to become seizure differential diagnosticians. It's not the case. Really, the type of seizure we're worried about in the emergency department is a generalized seizure. That's
right.
One where you lose consciousness. That's more serious. And the tonic-clonic ones where they have a fixed or rhythmic muscular motion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those are the dangerous types of seizures. And so that could be anything from the four limbs moving rhythmically together that we are used to seeing to just a fixed paralysis of the gaze to one side. There's other types of generalized seizures as well. They call them absence seizures. We used to call them petit mal. That's like an inattention seizure where someone, they don't lose their postural tone, but they zone out.
Mm-hmm.
Again, more common in kids and something that isn't as frequently encountered in the adult population. And so we should probably treat that in our pediatric section.
Right.
And then for the other types of seizures, the partial seizures, the ones where you don't lose consciousness, those are way more complicated and they're not going to present in the same way.
Right.
You know, like the so-called partial complex seizure, the temporal lobe epilepsy, that type of thing. It often presents as a personality change or altered mental status. It's not as likely to have the same sort of entry criteria into the algorithms that we're talking about?
A different approach entirely. So that's someone who's come in for an altered mental status workup, and that's something that we're not as stressed about in terms of controlling the seizure immediately.
So a seizure is basically any abnormal electrical activity up there in the brain. And it can have a motor component, so it can be a full tonic-clonic seizure where you're jumping around, boom, 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 all the limbs are moving. It can be partial where, say, just one limb is going. Or you can have seizures without any motor activity at all, and that is really hard to diagnose sometimes. So let's keep it simple. That's what we're talking about.
Chapter 2, History and Exam.
So just like you say, sometimes it's really obvious when someone is seizing. They're tonic-clonic, they're convulsing, they're hypoxic, their lips are blue. I know that's a seizure. But it's not always like that. Sometimes it's a lot more subtle. Or sometimes you just come in with the history that they had a seizure at home, and then we got to put on our thinking caps and try to sort that out, whether or not that really was a seizure. So let's talk about the history and exam of the patient who just seized. And we're going to chat with one of my residents, Dr. Nelson Diamond.
Well, my first question is always, do you have a history of seizures? Obviously, if they know this could be sort of run-of-the-mill, everyday type of thing for them. On the other hand, if it's a first-time seizure, then you have to think a little bit more.
And by think a little bit more, he means freak out and work this up. First-time seizure gets a workup, unless it's a little tiny baby with a fever. But a first-time seizure in an adult, this is not a good thing. This requires some, tests.
So if they do have a history of seizures, or even if they don't, you want to know about their medication history, because either they've changed their anti-epileptics recently, or they may have taken a medication that decreases their seizure threshold, so you want to think about that. Other things, then, if it's a first-time seizure, you want to make sure you think about anything that could affect the brain. So trauma. Did they hit their head? Were they in a car accident and had a seizure? That's a different differential. Do you also want to make sure they didn't hit their head afterwards? Could be a sequela of the seizure. They could have some kind of trauma. Then you want to think about, have they been sick recently?
So more specifically, like, what has been going up leading up to this seizure? Has something changed? Again, we're assuming adult nuanced seizure. What's changed? Has something gone on here? You've been losing weight, night sweats. Do you have things that might suggest this person's got cancer? Or, as you heard about, you know, a history of trauma. Or maybe they've tried some new herbal therapy that they've just found works really great and they're taking it in large quantities, causing them to seize. Extract of pro-seizure tree. That's bad. You shouldn't do that.
There's some electrolyte abnormalities that you'd want to think about. So have they been vomiting? Have they had anything else?
Although, let's be honest here, if you've got an electrolyte abnormality so severe that it causes seizures, you usually do not wake up between them. You are unconscious.
Fever, do they have a headache?
Yeah. Obviously, fever in and of itself in an adult doesn't produce a seizure, unless, of course, you have a seizure disorder that's underlying, and then a fever might drop that threshold. And then headache, we worry about progressive headache, space-occupying lesion, tumor, secondary, primary. And so generally, seizure plus headache that's progressive equals, you know, cancer, space occupying lesion, something bad.
You know, and just kind of round out a good review of systems.
I personally don't really know what a good review of systems is, except that it's something that you do every time on every patient so that it reminds you of the stuff you might otherwise forget. Get a system, because if you always think about asking about allergies, you always forget to ask about, you know, recent travel. Have a review of systems. You do the same every time, so you pick up those things you might not otherwise remember.
So Jess, I basically think exactly the same way that Nelson does. Unless I have a clear-cut history that this is a seizure in a patient who knows what a seizure is, who's had them before, who has a history of this, if everything isn't fitting into that chronic seizure history, that's one thing. But if it's not, then I really have to start thinking more about the cause of the seizure.
Yes.
Is this from an infection or a meningitis? Is this from substance abuse? Is this a drug of abuse? Is this an electrolyte disturbance? Is this alcohol-related? Is this trauma that I need to uncover that's happened here that no one knows about? And so really, is it cancer? You know, these are the things that enter my mind once I can't make it neatly fit into that, hey, this is just the same old seizure disorder that they've always had.
So we're going to go through the history, exam, and workup, but I think it's really important to call this out right up front that throughout all of this process, in our minds, we should always be asking the question, was this even a seizure? Because as you taught me, Dr. Swadron, when I was a young medical student, that there are many things that can look like seizures, including syncope. Syncope is sort of the big one. So as we go through history, exam, and workup, let's talk about that. So Nelson did great with the history, but what are some other things that you would add in that you want to find out?
Well, you know, he did a very good job of that in terms of identifying whether they were actually having a seizure. But one thing that he didn't mention was that there often are witnesses
yes.
to the event. Now, that can actually be a mixed blessing because some people have different ways of describing different things.
Right.
And I've certainly had people describe what they thought was a seizure and it turned out it wasn't at all.
And they also lose the sense of time.
No, that's
the
right.
Seizure
no,
was
I know it was an hour and a half and he was on the floor.
Right.
And yeah, exactly. And so it's not foolproof, but obviously you want to address that if it's at all possible.
Yes.
Because the person's unconscious by definition, they can't tell you exactly what happened when they were unconscious. And so that's very important. And then the other thing is, if things really aren't fitting into this pattern of a typical seizure for this patient, you know, this is, I've had epilepsy, this is very similar to what I've had in the past, witnesses confirm that it is similar to what I've had in the past, whatever the case may be, then you have to really start thinking about these other etiologies, serious things that cause seizures,
yes.
like infection, like meningitis. Could this be occult trauma? Could this be an electrolyte disorder? Could this be metastatic disease in a person that had breast cancer or prostate cancer, often goes to the brain, for example? So really, you're going to focus in on that differential fairly quickly.
And even the patients who do have an established seizure disorder, you also want to make sure that there isn't something else going on with them that has either triggered the seizure or some other secondary cause of a seizure. Like a person with epilepsy can still have meningitis.
Exactly. Or in a patient with seizure disorder can still have a syncopal episode.
Absolutely.
And so we really have to take a good history.
Let's talk about the exam and let's hear it from Nelson Diamond.
So the first thing I always think about that you jump to is, you know, findings that might be more consistent with a seizure, because obviously the subtext is that you might be trying to differentiate what looks like seizure with something else, like syncope. So things that are more consistent with seizure are tongue biting and urinary continence. Those are like the two hallmarks.
And the tongue biting specifically in a seizure patient is lateral tongue biting. We all bite our tongues, we're not seizing. But biting the tongue along the sides, that's very specific for a seizure if you see that. And of course, whizzing on yourself. But sometimes I do that without a seizure.
But don't forget, in addition, you want to do a good thorough neuro exam because it's a neurologic problem. So you want to get a good look at the pupils. You do your thorough strength and sensation testing. We mentioned a little bit earlier that like a fever would be an important finding in a seizure, and you want to get a full set of vitals as well. Make sure you don't forget that fever. Nuchal rigidity goes along with the fever seizure diagnosis that we're hinting at.
Well, let us not hint, let us state explicitly. In an adult, fever plus new onset seizure equals what?
Think encephalitis.
Right.
Think encephalitis.
Right.
And I think that what is actually encephalitis. You might think meningitis, but it's really, there's something wrong with their brain. There's a brain abscess, there's encephalitis. And generally, these people are sick, 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 sick.
And then think about, again, we talked about sequelae of seizures.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do a good musculoskeletal exam, including like the classic board answer is posterior shoulder being associated with seizures. So those are kind of some of the highlights.
Nelson makes some really good points here. So not only are we looking for clues as to why the patient had a seizure, but just as he said, we're looking for sequelae of their fall, of their trauma. So you're making sure head to toe, you're looking for signs of trauma and musculoskeletal injury. Again, pointing out vital signs, including the temperature. You want them on a monitor. You want to see if they're hypoxic, especially if they're still seizing. And so we're really looking for both the reasons why they seized and any sequelae of that seizure.
Yeah, and you mentioned actually their temperature, and it's true that the temperature can go up, Jess, in a seizure,
mm-hmm.
but be really careful. I wouldn't assume that. I would assume that if they have a significant fever with a seizure, you really have to go down the, hey, could this be meningitis? Could this be an intracranial bleed pathway? You wouldn't assume it was from just the seizure
right.
activity.
That's
an important
point.
Pitfall. But yeah, I totally agree with the way that Nelson laid that out. You're looking for confirming that this was a seizure on physical exam at the same time as you're looking for clues for what the etiology might be, exactly that approach. And Jess, in terms of the things that differentiate seizure from syncope on examination, he alluded mm-hmm. to several of those. I just wanted to point out that the incontinence has been found to be a bit overrated.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily distinguish syncope from seizures from other things too well. And so that one I wouldn't focus on. But tongue biting
mm-hmm.
in the literature has been found to be very specific for seizures. And so that strongly suggests it was a seizure. Also, huge one, if they're confused, so if there's witness report of them being confused, or if they are still confused after the event, That's highly suggestive of seizure as opposed to syncope. And then one more thing, as they get older, syncope becomes more of an issue, life-threatening syncope. And so in the younger age of the spectrum, if they're under 45, for example, that also greatly increases the chance that it was a seizure, the episode that they discussed. So those are just some of the things for distinguishing the two.
Perfect. And then when you see the patient, as Nelson pointed out, you're doing a neuro exam, a full neuro exam, because you can have this phenomena of Todd's paralysis. So you can have these residual neurologic deficits when the patient is still recovering from their seizure, and usually doesn't last very long. Usually it should be resolved within about 30 minutes or so.
It's a really interesting phenomena, and it's also very clinically important, because people that have a residual paralysis or neurologic deficit, they're usually unilateral.
Mm-hmm.
After a seizure, so often are mistaken for strokes.
Right.
And so one of the common reasons that we misadminister TPA to a presumed stroke patient is actually a seizure with Todd's paralysis.
Right. Yeah, that is really tricky.
Chapter 3, Workup.
And finally, there's the actual workup of the seizure patient in the ED. So let's go over the labs and the imaging and what more we need to do for that patient at that point.
Labs.
Potentially, you could get no labs if you have a person who has a history of seizure, and this is a classic seizure, and they seem to be well now. However, as you sort of, you know, go down your list, and if the situation gets a little bit more complex, if someone's actively seizing, you should always check a glucose. And if I have any question at all, I have a low threshold to check a glucose, even if someone looks well afterwards. Then if you do have some recent illness or some other reason for someone's electrolytes to be abnormal, then you should check a chem. The most common electrolyte to think about being sodium. So think about hyponatremia and seizure. But there's some other ones that can do it too. And don't forget, the magnesium is one that can cause it, which doesn't come on the regular chem panel. So that's a lab that you have to add.
So can I state again, generally, if an electrolyte abnormality has caused you to have a seizure, you don't usually wake up between, because the electrolyte abnormality is so bad that it made you seize. These don't get better very quickly. Maybe if you're in a marathon or something like that and you have acute hyponatremia, maybe you seize and you can wake up. But with talking about sort of grandma seizing because her sodium's low, grandma's not going to wake up and say, "Ah, it's because my sodium's low, mate."
And then if the clinical setting suggests it, don't forget about tox causing seizures. So that's where you might want to throw on your, you know, add your osmoles and all the more complicated stuff to work up. If you do or don't have an anion gap, you know, obviously those can be transient findings, and think about adding on things like salicylates and go down that whole road.
But just hang on a second here, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, because what is the most common cause of a high anion gap in somebody who's just had a seizure? Lactic acidosis, thank you. And then it magically disappears after they stop seizing and they circulate it all away. All right, keep that in mind.
Yeah, so I agree with Nelson. Sometimes you don't need any labs at all. But if you're going to get labs, sometimes it can be really helpful if you have a suspicion for hyponatremia or hypoglycemia. Some other things you might see is a lactic acidosis. So that lactate can get really high and it usually resolves pretty quickly. And also, don't forget the pregnancy test. Always get the pregnancy test.
Oh, snap. Yeah, you better remember the pregnancy test, because if you don't, then you could be dealing with eclampsia that is no longer pre-eclamptic. It is now fully eclamptic, and that is bad. In fact, we've got a fantastic case in our rural medicine series on just such an event.
And then another one that there's some talk about in the literature is prolactin. The prolactin can be elevated if you're able to draw that within like the first 20 minutes or so after their seizure, then that can be helpful in figuring out, was it actually a seizure or not? So I have a question for you, Stuart. If you're asking yourself that question, seizure or syncope or seizure mimic, do you get a lactate and a prolactin to help you differentiate that?
You know, the usual circumstance in which the lactate is elevated after a seizure is just because the patient came in sick as heck and a lot of labs were done that included a lactate. And it's like, oh, the lactate was really high. Then maybe they had a seizure before they came here. It's not usually the type of thing where we're talking to a patient and trying to wonder if they had a seizure or not. And then we're, oh, let's order a lactate to see if whether or not you're describing a seizure. Or a prolactin level, for that matter. These are not really, they're important to know about, and they come up on the test all the time, but they're, practically speaking, not what we use to sort this out. Practically speaking, we're going to take a good history and physical, and if necessary to eliminate seizure, we're going to do an EEG. I don't think that we're ready for prime time on using those as definitive tests to rule in or rule out seizure.
Great. And speaking of EEG, Tell me about the ECG.
Well, that's great. You know, that's a great question because, you know, it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine, as some people know. But every time I think about seizure, especially if it's a first-time seizure, I think, hey, could this have been something even more serious, like a cardiac arrhythmia, mm-hmm. like VTAC? And so I think for first-time seizures, an ECG is absolutely appropriate to look for anything that might result in an arrhythmia and all the things that we talk about all the time in emergency medicine, like Brugada syndrome and WPW and these and VTAC, of course, things that could have easily mimicked a seizure or resulted in a seizure.
Okay, great. So we got our labs. We talked about our ECG. What about imaging, head imaging in particular?
Well, you know, you don't need to image most patients that come with a chief complaint of seizure. Just like we were talking about, they might not get any investigations. If you have a patient who has a seizure every 2 months and that hasn't changed and they're on the same medications and they seem to be reliable in their follow-up, no investigations at all may be necessary. You do a CT in two sort of circumstances, okay. Jess. One of them is when they've had their typical seizure, but they've hit their head real bad,
right.
And they've got blood coming out of their ear, and they've got, you know, a skull fracture clinically.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, if you think there's serious head trauma going on and they're not coming to like they usually do after a seizure, absolutely, you're going to CT their head. So that's the one circumstance. And then, of course, the other time is when the etiology is in question. It's a first-time seizure.
Yes.
Who knows? Is it a tumor? Is it a bleed? So those are sort of the two groups of patients that get CT scans.
Okay, and then there's the lumbar puncture.
The only patients that really need a lumbar puncture are ones where you think there might be an infectious etiology. And so, you know, any of the obvious signs of infection, like rashes and fevers, those are lumbar puncture patients after the CT. And then anyone who's immunocompromised, because they don't necessarily show the signs of bad infection. They might not have the fever if you have HIV. You might not have a white count if you're on 100 of prednisone a day for your lupus, that type of thing. So immunocompromised people, patients with obvious manifestations of infection, both will need an LP if it's a seizure that's not explained.
So let me summarize it again. Let me make it very explicit. If somebody has a known seizure disorder that comes to your emergency department or urgent care or wherever you're at, and it's really typical for them and they've had no trauma because of it, then they really usually need nothing. And in fact, they probably don't even need to be transported to get seen because this is expected. This is what happens. And they get transported because somebody freaks out. But most of the time, normal seizure in somebody who has seizures, it's not more frequent, no trauma, do nothing. New seizure, work them up.
So I just want to go through those seizure mimics one more time because we spent some time there on syncope versus seizures, but there's some other ones, right, Stuart?
That's right. The big one that differentiate, obviously, is syncope, but there's other things that you're going to encounter in your travels that mimic seizures. And some of them are actually in sick medical patients, like patients with liver disease and kidney disease can have movement disorders related to that, for mm-hmm. example. And there's all kinds of other neurologic syndromes like movement disorders, tremor disorders. All of those can be mistaken for seizures.
And then the other thing, and we're going to come back to this, we're going to talk about it in greater detail at the end, but the psychogenic seizures, I don't want to just omit that right here. We're going to talk about that in more detail at the end.
Yeah, and it's important to recognize that psychogenic seizures, a so-called pseudo-seizure,
mm-hmm.
is actually quite common in patients that have seizure disorders. So even if they have a seizure disorder, their actual presentation might be for a pseudo-seizure.
That was a little teaser, a little seizure teaser.
A teaser, as it were.
That's right.
Okay.
Chapter 4, Status Epilepticus.
So let's start this section out with just a definition. What is status epilepticus?
The definition of status epilepticus is totally just a moving target.
Right.
So if you've been at this for a while, you know, a few decades ago, they would say that it has to be 30 minutes long of seizing before you call it status epilepticus, that kind of thing. And that number has sort of crept down every year. It gets lower and lower. And I think the current number that we're at is 5 minutes. The fact of the matter is here is that the vast majority of seizures are self-limited. Okay, patient seizes, and then they're postictal, and then they're better.
Right.
And if it doesn't fit into that category, like they've been seizing in the field, and they're still seizing when they get to your emergency department, the paramedics have already administered some benzodiazepines, that's status. For all of our diagnostic considerations, that's status. And we're going to start treating all those people that have ongoing seizures or that have a set of seizures that they're not returning to baseline with, we're going to treat them all like they're status now.
So someone comes in who's actively seizing and we're assuming it's status because by the time they got to us, it must have been going on for several minutes at a minimum. EMS gave them some benzodiazepine in the field. So by the time that you get them, you're treating status epilepticus. Some of the first things that we're going to do are just the simple protective measures. And we're doing this in parallel while we're going to start our Status Epilepticus algorithm to treat the seizure. So protective measures, simple stuff. The patient should be rolled on their side because they're probably going to vomit and we don't want them to aspirate. You're going to have suction ready at the bedside. You want to oxygenate them, so put a non-rebreather on. And then you're going to check a glucose immediately. All this is happening while you're working on getting access. There's a lot to do here. So in terms of actually stopping the seizure, let's go through your algorithm, Stuart. What do you do, assuming they already got some benzodiazepine in the field?
Well, I think the main thing to recognize here is that when someone is really actively seizing and they have big time tonic-clonic seizures, you can't do anything until the seizures stop. I mean, so it's all that you can do to get them in a safe position and try to supply some oxygen. But obviously, anything else you want to do to the patient kind of depends on you stopping the seizure. So other than sort of paying as much attention to the airway as you can and their safety and trying to get access any way you can, which, you know, a lot of times if they're still seizing ends up being something like an IO.
An IO, yeah.
Because you can't steady them enough to get an IV in. And even sometimes that's difficult and you have to give IM medications, right? But it really starts with stopping the seizure, and that is benzos, benzos, benzos. And so, you know, there is no right answer to what benzo to use. They might use in the system that you work in diazepam, they might use lorazepam, they might use midazolam. All those are acceptable. Generally speaking, if they're still seizing when they arrive in the emergency department, you're going to redose them with benzos, and you're usually going to give them a few doses of benzos before you go to your next agent.
So after they've gotten their benzodiazepine redosed, now it's time to go to a second line agent, right, Stuart? And there's a lot of options here. So which one are you reaching for your second line?
Yeah, it reminds me of the old Huey Lewis song, I Want a New Drug. And that's exactly what happens. After your benzos aren't working, and you can try different benzos, by the way. I mean, you can combine two different types of benzos. It's okay to give, for example, diazepam, if lorazepam has already been given, because there can be some complementary actions between those. But generally speaking, after the benzos, you're going to go to something like a phenytoin.
Mm-hmm.
And often the phenytoin is given in the phosphenytoin version of the drug,
mm-hmm,
because it's water soluble and it can be given more rapidly. So in a status epilepticus type of circumstance where you want to get the seizures stopped quickly, giving intravenous phosphenytoin or intramuscular phosphenytoin will be absorbed more quickly and will stop the seizure more quickly. Other agents that fall into that second line category would include valproic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what's great about both phenytoin and valproic acid is that they both don't lower your level of consciousness that much. They don't make you comatose. And so in a patient who's unconscious, by definition, they're having a generalized seizure, who you want to follow moving forward, you want to know, hey, is the coma from the ongoing seizure action,
mm-hmm,
or is the coma just from the effects of the drug with the benzos that you're giving?
Right.
Well, with these non-sedating drugs like phenytoin and valproic acid, they don't interfere with that distinction. And so it's much better to get rid of the seizure and have the patient still be somewhat conscious if you can get away with it.
So we got phenytoin, phosphenytoin, we have valproic acid. What about levetiracetam?
I like that one as well. That's one of the newer kids on the block. And we've been using it for several years now. And it also doesn't sedate the patient that much. So there's another potential advantage to using levetiracetam.
Also known as Keppra, also known as the most difficult drug name in all of the world to say. Right? Levetiracetam. Levetiracetam. Levetamacetam.
Levetiracetam.
And then another one is lacosamide.
And that's another new one. And I don't have as much experience with that. And basically, those sort of second tier of medications often will get you out of trouble without having to intubate the patient sometimes and stop the seizures. But if you've already gone through your benzos and your second line drugs, you're going to basically have to snow them, is what,
mm-hmm,
I would say.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to give them much bigger doses of midazolam is one technique. So even more benzos, giving them propofol, which is basically a general anesthetic, a phenobarbital or other barbiturate will put them again in a deep coma. So those are sort of the big guns at the end of this process. If the first line benzos and the second line drugs haven't worked, you're going to basically put them under and it becomes like a general anesthetic. And you're going to probably have to intubate them at that point in
time.
Yes,
yeah, the elephant in the room. That patient needs an endotracheal tube. So let's say you have someone that you've basically done the whole kitchen sink. You've given them the second line agent. You've intubated them. And you get to choose which sedative agent you're going to put them on. Which one is your go-to?
Well, these days it's propofol. And I think that's becoming a lot more common throughout the United States anyway. But your other options include, as we mentioned, a benzo drip. You can use a barbiturate drip like pentothal. Propofol is probably one of the best choices now, especially if there's no concerns about volume loss because it can cause some hypotension. I think that's probably your go-to.
So at this point in the case, if you've had to manage their airway, you've probably also given them a paralytic. And in that case, you really have no idea if they're still seizing because there's no convulsions that you'll be able to see.
That's an incredibly important point. And you know, anyone that you get this far down the pathway in, status epilepticus that you've given multiple drugs to, even just sometimes when you haven't given them a long-acting paralytic like rocuronium, you have to be darn sure that you've stopped the seizure. And so the first element of that is an extremely careful physical exam, an ongoing physical exam that examines a patient very carefully for any rhythmic movements. Even I've seen patients sometimes just with a twitching finger on one side, very subtle, or with a tonic deviation of the eyes to one side, but no other manifestations. You've got to watch the patients carefully for things like that because they still might be seizing, especially when we're half hour, 45 minutes into this case. Their muscles have kind of gotten exhausted. The convulsions might have sort of settled down, but they still might be seizing. And so that's the time, Jess, where you might actually be getting an EEG in the emergency department. Doesn't happen often, but right. In any patient mm-hmm. that we go this far down the seizure algorithm and we're not still sure, for sure, that they're not seizing anymore, we want to make sure we actually either get neurology to come down and do an EEG, or a lot of emergency departments now have these bispectral kind of ED versions, simplified mm-hmm. EEG, that can tell you with a fairly simple procedure if they're still seeing seizure activity on
right.
the EEG.
The spot EEG, just right. a quick look for a few minutes.
Exactly.
Okay, great. So let's recap that. Let's do a quick little summary of the approach to status. So patients coming in, they've probably gotten some benzos in the field by EMS. If not, you're giving that immediately and you're giving a repeat dose after just, what, a couple minutes?
Exactly.
Okay. We are working on the obvious stuff here, access, getting them on the monitor, oxygenating them, protecting their airway. We're quickly going to move to our second line agent within about 5 minutes. You want to go to your second line agent. And the reason for that, I don't know we explicitly said it, but seizures that last more than 5 minutes are unlikely to just stop on their
own. Exactly right. Just like we were saying, the vast majority of seizures are short and self-limited.
So by 5 minutes, you're giving your second line agent. And no clear consensus here on which medication that should be, but phenytoin, phosphenytoin, valproic acid, and some of the newer ones, these are all reasonable options. And then we're managing the airway, and we're thinking about putting the patient on either a propofol or benzodiazepine drip, or maybe a barbiturate.
That's basically the sequence of events. And, you know, this whole time, you're so preoccupied on stopping the seizure, appropriately, you're rest of your brain has to be kind of thinking, hey, I wonder what's underlying all of this. And that's sort of right. what the parallel processing that's going on at the same time. Hey, is this trauma, meningitis? Is this, you know, just happened to be an out of control seizure in an epileptic? That's sort of your diagnosis of exclusion. You really want to think about the serious diagnoses up front in a status patient.
Chapter 5, Known Seizure Disorders.
Let's talk specifically about seizures in a patient who has a known seizure disorder. And let's hear it from Dr. Diamond.
So in that population specifically, like we talked about, we want to know what medications they're on and if there's been any recent changes. Some medications we can check a level. So that is an important thing to know if that's going to be something that we'll get back in an hour or in 2 days, and then it's not really helpful to us, or 2 weeks in some cases. And then you also want to know, you know, who they're seeing. That those people usually should be followed either by primary care or hopefully by a neurologist. Those are the main things I ask people who have seizure history.
Once again, Dr. Diamond doing us a solid, Jess.
Dr. Diamond.
I mean, the basic pitfall in seizures that are regular, typical epileptic seizures in the ER is to do too much.
Yes.
That's the main pitfall. And so what you're trying to establish, like we were alluding to before, was, is this a typical seizure for them? Is there anything unusual about it? Did they have trauma that's above and beyond what they usually have from their seizures that needs to be worked up? What is the pattern of their seizures? Is this a departure from the regular pattern? And, you know, most of the time it's not. And mm-hmm. you just don't need to do anything. You know, you usually have one seizure every 2 or 3 months and there's no change.
So we frequently see these patients in the emergency department, someone who had a very typical seizure for them, but they had it while they were at school or at work. And so whoever they're with freaks out, calls EMS, and brings them to us. So one thing that I try to figure out is whether or not they would have come in, or if their parent is with them, would you have brought them in had you witnessed this seizure? Because that's a patient that probably needs nothing done, like you said, if it fits with their seizure pattern.
That's exactly what I asked them.
So just like Nelson mentioned, there are some certain anti-epileptic drugs that you can get levels on, and notably this is phenytoin, valproic acid, and carbamazepine.
That's right. Because some of those newer agents that we mentioned, you know, it's really hard to get levels on them. It could be very expensive. They could take several days, send out labs, that type of thing. So you're not really responsible for those ones.
And the reason why getting that level can be important is because if the level is low, then we want to know that because we can treat that.
Yeah, certainly if the patient's having seizures or an increased frequency of seizures and their levels are low, it's a pretty straightforward thing. You got to get those levels back up. That might mean a load of the drug that they're on. It might be increasing the dose. It might be a frank discussion about compliance or adherence to medication. So those are all the things that go through your mind. Probably what's more confusing to people is what to do when the levels are normal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, geez, do I need to do something about this? And often it's because an epileptic patient will have, for example, 3 seizures in a day or an increased frequency of seizures for a week, maybe because they're stressed out or because there's been a change in weather or it's exams and they're a student. You know, there's all kinds of things that could precipitate them getting worse with their epilepsy, but the bottom line is they look okay and they're otherwise, you know, feeling well, their vitals are good. Just because they've had more seizures in the past few days or the past few weeks than they usually have doesn't necessarily mean they can't go home and follow up with their neurologist or primary care provider. They might need adjustment in medications. They might need additional medications, but you don't necessarily need to do any more workup if they look okay and they do have an established history of seizures. It could be very appropriate for them to follow up with an outpatient neurologist or family doctor.
Perfect. I love it. And then another question that comes up frequently is how long do you observe the patient for? For me, it's basically when they're back to baseline. If they're still post-ictal, hang on to them. When they return to baseline, they can go.
Pretty much.
Chapter 6, new onset seizures.
So we talked about status. We talked about seizure in the epilepsy patient. Now we're going to talk about the first time seizure in the adult. Nelson, there's a patient coming in with a first time seizure. You want to see her with me?
Yeah, absolutely.
How old are you?
I'm 21.
And what happened today that brought you to the ER?
I had a seizure at work.
What do you remember happening?
So I remember feeling really dizzy and kind of lightheaded.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started drinking water and then it wouldn't go away. So then it just happened so fast. And then all of a sudden I woke up and then the paramedics were there. I don't remember anything after that.
Did you get hurt at all?
No, someone caught me before I hit the floor, and then I guess like I woke up right away. I wasn't really responding at first, and then when the paramedics came, I started talking and stuff.
And then how'd you feel after that?
I felt fine. Like right when they sat me up and stuff, I could walk and everything. I was fine. It's just I was just scared. I didn't really know what was going on.
Did you feel confused?
Yeah, I felt confused. I kept asking like what happened, what's going on. They just said that I had a seizure, or that I passed out. But I feel fine now. Yeah.
Has this ever happened before?
No, it's never happened before. This is the first time.
And what other medical problems do you have?
None. Just the disease that I forgot what it's called. Can't pronounce it.
Adrenal hyperplasia.
Yeah, adrenal hyperplasia. Yeah.
Are you on medication for that?
Hydrocortisone. Yeah.
What'd you get on her exam?
So at this point, her mental status is normal. We got a full set of vitals. She does not have a fever, and her vital signs are all normal otherwise. She's not tachycardic. She's got a normal blood pressure. And on her neuro exam, she doesn't really have any deficits. Now, interestingly, like we talked about, one of the big hallmark findings we did, I looked in her mouth, and sure enough, she bit her tongue. So that does sort of steer me towards thinking this is a real seizure, but no urinary incontinence.
Did we get an EKG on her?
Yes, we did.
How's that look?
It looks normal. And we also got a pregnancy test on her, and she's not pregnant.
Cool. So do you want to run any other tests on her? We have a pregnancy test and an EKG. Is there anything else that you want to do?
Yeah, so she has a unique past medical history, which is adrenal hyperplasia, which can cause some electrolyte abnormalities. So I think in a first-time seizure in this patient, a chem is definitely indicated. So we got that, and we also got a point-of-care glucose just to get it quickly.
And what do those show?
Also normal. Normal sugar and normal sodium were the two things that I was looking for particularly.
Okay, so Nelson did a great job with this case, I thought. And interestingly, when I spoke with the patient's mother a little bit, I got some additional history because The way the patient describes this episode, it really sounds like it could have been syncope, and it really highlights how difficult it is to distinguish seizure from syncope. But I also found out that the patient's sister has a seizure disorder, and then that the coworkers describe this state of just her being very confused after the episode. So that and the tongue biting really pointed more towards seizure for her. And she does have that interesting history of the adrenal hyperplasia.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep an open mind because, you know, even after someone has been seen one or two times before you with what was presumed to be either syncope or seizure, they might have got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so until the diagnosis is sort of firmly established, you got to be really open-minded about it.
And then we did check the chemistry panel on her because of her unique history.
So in this patient, it's actually quite interesting. They had an interesting medical disorder, adrenal hyperplasia. And I don't think we need to go into a lot of detail on that particularly, other than to say that with some of these endocrine problems, patients might seize because of electrolyte abnormalities.
And of note, which we didn't specifically mention, but we did not start this patient on an anti-epileptic medication.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to. There's no right or wrong answer there. But definitely after a first-time seizure, you're definitely in the clear, so to speak, if you don't start an anti-epileptic while the workup is still occurring. And there's some support for that from the American College of Emergency Physicians clinical policy that you don't necessarily have to start an anti-epileptic after the first incident like this, especially in view of what we were saying, Jess, is that you might not have a final diagnosis. We still might have that open mind about what is going on at the beginning.
All right, so let's just go through the other secondary causes of seizures.
These are the things you just don't want to miss.
You can't miss them on your new seizure patient. Now, we've said this one a bunch. I'm going to say it again because it's so important. So we're going to do it again. Cardiac arrhythmias, and that's why everyone with seizure versus syncope gets an ECG.
Absolutely, and there's a whole list of things we're looking for, and those are all summarized in our EKG and syncope talk for anyone who wants to review them. But basically, there's a list of about 8 or 9 things that you're looking for in that ECG as a clue that this might have been an arrhythmia.
Yes. Next, you're considering the possibility for some sort of structural lesion, whether that's a mass or maybe it's the fibrotic lesions of a neurocysticercosis.
And we also mentioned that as well. You're going to pick most of those up on CT scan. And certainly for any older patients that present with new onset seizure, that's pretty much part of the workup. For the younger people, there's leeway not to do CT and use ionized radiation. And so that one you're going to have to play by ear. But certainly, again, anyone who's older or with a history of a malignancy, that CT's got to be there to rule out these things.
So let's go over that again. They're talking about new onset seizure in the adult, and I will add in there that is now fine. So they had what appears to be a seizure episode. They come into the emergency department or to the urgent care or wherever you're at. What do you do? The first thing that comes up all the time is, was it really a seizure? So seizure versus syncope is one of the biggest diagnostic dilemmas that you're going to deal with, particularly if there wasn't anybody there to witness the event. And obviously it's an important branch point because if it's syncope, then after a good history and physical examination, if you want to do further workup, you're obviously going to work up their heart. And if you think it's a seizure and you're going to do further investigations, you're going to look at their brain. And the brain and the heart are two different things, I'm just saying. So let's just spend a little bit of time on that differentiation again from the history. So the preceding symptoms of a syncope generally is something like you feel nauseous, you've got sort of blurred vision, whereas with a seizure, you might smell something, you might sort of have some weird motor phenomenon. In terms of position, well, with syncope, usually you're sitting or standing. With seizures, it can occur in any position. In terms of how quickly it happens, usually with a syncopal episode, you sort of slowly fade away and you slip down and slide onto the carpet. Whereas with a seizure, it's usually abrupt. You're usually just sort of out. Generally, in syncope patients, they are pale. They're getting less and less blood flow to their skin and then they go out. And with seizures, classically, they're sort of turning blue. In terms of eye deviation, you can get it with both seizures and syncope, but it's usually sustained and lateral to the side when you're having a seizure. Incontinence is common in both, so that's not very helpful. Tongue biting is really common in seizure patients, classically that lateral tongue biting. You can have convulsions in syncope or seizures, but usually the convulsions that you have in seizures are unmistakable and they're often quite lengthy. Whereas when you have a syncopal episode, you might have a few sort of tonic-clonic jerks, just a couple, but not usually sustained. And in the postictal period, you're often confused after a seizure for, you know, minutes. Whereas with syncope, usually they're just like, oh, what happened? And then they wake up. So there's some of the things you can use. None of them are perfect. And that's why it's hard.
So it's been like, what, maybe an hour since she had her seizure?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to do at this point? Like, how long do you think that we need to observe her? And do you think she can go home?
I mean, at this point, she's back to normal. She's got a normal mental status. She doesn't have a Todd's paralysis or anything that we need to watch to get better. So she could go now, really.
Did you report her to the DMV?
We unfortunately did have to report her to the DMV. It's a difficult conversation to have, but with all these first-time seizures, I usually tell them and document in my chart. This is probably even more important than the CMR card, but we make sure that we send the report into the DMV and then let the patient know that they should stop driving right away, even though we're not going to ask for their driver's license because they could hurt themselves or someone else.
Yeah. All right, good case. Sounds good.
Thanks.
So let me go back in time a little bit and talk about a few of the other things. So, workup for these patients, sure, they're going to get a glucose even if they're awake. They're going to get electrolytes, let's be honest. Do you really need it if they're awake? In most cases, probably no. The real controversy is neuroimaging. If they're completely back to baseline, have a completely normal neurological exam, are you going to send that person away without neuroimaging? Most people, I would say, are going to get a CAT scan or an MRI today, just to make sure there is no space-occupying lesion of some form. If that's negative, and most of the time it is, then they'll get further outpatient workup with EEGs and neurologists and other people generally. Although some people say you're allowed to have one seizure. You're allowed to, as an adult, you're allowed to have one seizure and you don't need to go on chronic anti-epileptic medications and you don't necessarily need an extensive workup to work out why this happened. But in general, they're going to get neuroimaging and they don't necessarily need to be started on anti-epileptic medications according to ACEP and other groups as well. Again, you get that one freebie before you have to start chronic therapy. And then they talked here at the end about reporting. It's different from state to state. In California, it's mandatory reporting. We could go into a whole discussion about that because it's actually incredibly rare for seizures to cause car accidents, for example. There are many other things that cause car accidents more frequently than seizures, for example, alcohol, but that's a whole nother discussion. So again, good history, good physical examination. You don't necessarily need to start them on anti-epileptic medications. You are going to get them follow-up. Probably most people are going to get imaging today now just to make sure there's not a space-occupying lesion and then further workup as an outpatient. Again, for that person who's come in, had a seizure, and now is completely back to baseline.
So the next big category is cerebrovascular stuff. We're talking about basically our strokes and our bleeds. This is bad stuff that you don't want to miss. But basically what I would say about that is that in most of the patients with strokes, you're going to have some neurologic symptoms and signs and findings, right? And so that's the main thing there is just to do a good HMP to rule out stroke. Because remember, CT does not rule out stroke initially, right? The CT initially will look normal in ischemic stroke. The one thing that CT is very good at ruling out, though, Jess, is the bleeds. And so if there's a headache component to this presentation, if that's a big part of it, then you know, sometimes even without any findings, you're going to do a CT to make sure there's not a bleed there.
Right. And that also goes back to what we were saying about lumbar puncture. Who gets the LP? It's also the patients who you're going down the subarachnoid pathway for, the CT-LP.
Yes.
Cool. Next category, infections. We've talked about this a lot throughout the episode, so I won't harp on it, but make sure you're considering meningitis, encephalitis, and brain abscess.
Trauma is another important thing to think about. Remember, you could seize as a result of head injury, and not all patients will tell you necessarily that they've had a head injury for whatever reason. And so at least a thought, hey, could there have been a trauma here?
Metabolic, another really important category. We've talked about this one a lot. Hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia, if it's high enough. Hyponatremia, hypocalcemia, and hypomagnesemia. So you're getting your chemistry panel for the appropriate patient and adding on the magnesium.
And then, of course, there's a lot of toxicologic causes of seizures. I mean, there's too many to mention. It's basically hundreds and hundreds of drugs.
Isn't it every single toxidrome ends with seizure coma death?
Right. You give enough of it, it can cause seizures, basically. And so, you know, you're not, and no one's suggesting that you're shotgunning a million toxicologic tests here. It's basically history and physical. Are there any clues to a possible toxidrome on physical exam that would go to suggest further testing? But this is going to be on a case-by-case basis.
And also, not just intoxication, but withdrawal syndromes can also be associated with seizures, particularly with alcohol, benzodiazepines, and barbiturates.
That's a really good point. Now, we should never really jump to the conclusion that a seizure is from alcohol withdrawal, again, before going through all those other more serious diagnoses.
Yes.
But again, it turns out to be a very common cause.
All right. Now, most patients who are seizing are going to get benzos and benzos are going to help them. But sometimes the benzos don't help because there's some other reason why the patient's seizing.
Exactly right. And we should probably go through some of those. Why don't we do it in sort of like a game show type fashion?
Hey, that's a good idea. Are you up for a game, Stuart?
Yeah.
Can I quiz you?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to quiz you.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to say the reason for the seizure, and you're going to tell me the treatment for the seizure.
Okay.
Okay, ready? Eclampsia.
That's magnesium.
Yes. Isoniazid overdose.
Isoniazid overdose, that would be pyridoxine, vitamin B6.
Yes. Hypoglycemia, tough one.
Hypoglycemia. That one, you're going to have to help me on that one. What do you do for that one?
It's a D followed by a number.
D50.
Yes, that's good.
D-something. Something, yeah.
Something with dextrose.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Okay, how about hyponatremia?
Okay, so their sodium is low.
Low sodium.
And they're seizing, mm-hmm. And so that's an emergency. You want to use something hypertonic, like a 3% hypertonic saline solution.
Yes. Okay, now the next three are going to go together. It's overdose of any one of the following: aspirin, TCAs, or lithium.
Well, I know the answer for that is classically dialysis, and it's not the kind of thing you can set up right away, so they're going to be getting obviously other things in the interim. But yeah, I think that you might have to dialyze patients that are seizing from those overdoses. That's what I've been taught.
Love it. And finally, meningitis.
Well, there's it's a good question. It's maybe a trick question, because I think the right answer is steroids and then antibiotics, because there is that body of literature out there that shows that their outcomes are better for meningitis if they get a dose of dexamethasone before or at the time when the antibiotics are first administered. So I think that's worth reminding people of.
Chapter 7, Special Populations.
Let's take a minute and focus on some of the special populations that we have to treat a little bit differently than the other seizure patients. And we've discussed this a little bit throughout the episode, but let's hone in here. So what about the patient with HIV/AIDS?
Well, that's actually not that difficult in a lot of respects, Jess, because if they have AIDS, okay, if a patient has frank AIDS and they present with the new onset seizure, you know, that's got to be worked up fully. That's the patient who's getting the full meal deal. They're going to get the CT. They're going to need an LP as well, because there's lots of structural lesions that these patients get that are opportunistic that can cause seizures. There's lots of infections that they can get, including cryptococcus, which is common in patients with AIDS. If they've got HIV positivity and they're being well treated and they've got a healthy CD4 count, you might not need to go through as extensive a workup, but certainly you're going to really be concerned about some of these secondary causes in a patient with HIV/AIDS.
And in addition to the infections that they're more susceptible to, there is also HIV encephalopathy. And then there's also the demyelinating processes like PML, progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy.
That's right. And so after the initial CT and LP are done in these patients, you often have to go further to MRIs to diagnose some of these other seizure-causing things that patients get with HIV.
The next category is seizure in the pregnant patient.
Pregnancy is an important category, because if you have a seizure when you're pregnant, there's a good chance that's something pretty serious. Now, we all know about eclampsia.
Right.
And so that's the first thing that everyone thinks about when you think about a seizure in pregnancy. And it's absolutely the first thing on your differential.
Should be, yes.
And you may even be starting magnesium intravenously on that patient while you're actually working through the rest of your differential, because that kind of has to be addressed right off the bat. But there's some other really serious things that also cause seizures in pregnancy that you shouldn't forget about. One of them is cerebral venous thrombosis. Remember that pregnancy is a hypercoagulable state. And so you can present with blood clots in the veins of your brain that cause a very serious stroke-like syndrome and seizures. That's another thing. And there's a bunch of other things too that we don't necessarily have to get into all the details, but seizure, pregnancy, concerning.
Yes, absolutely. Another important category is alcohol-dependent patients, particularly when they're withdrawing, but also when they're just intoxicated and seizing. You have to think about head trauma. You have to go looking for that subdural that they might have if there's signs of head trauma. For the alcohol withdrawal patients, it's benzos, benzos, benzos.
You know, in terms of alcohol withdrawal seizures, Jess, this is something that I think is pretty misunderstood. A lot of people think of an alcohol withdrawal seizure as the end stage of alcohol withdrawal. You know, they've already been anxious and tremulous and they get delirious. And then the ultimate thing is that they might have a seizure. In actual fact, seizures are usually a pretty early manifestation of alcohol withdrawal. So the more typical pattern is that a patient will maybe be a little bit anxious, but just all of a sudden have a seizure. And they're typically very rapid tonic-clonic seizures that resolve very quickly, and then they might seem okay afterwards. And then only after a few hours do they start getting the real tremors. And so it can be a quite an early manifestation of alcohol withdrawal. And if you keep that in mind, you might not miss some of these.
And finally, and yes, we did save this for last, are the psychogenic seizures. The proper term is the psychogenic non-epileptic seizures.
Yeah, we used to call these pseudo-seizures.
Right. That is the outdated, less politically correct term.
Fake seizures. That's how we used to say it.
You're just telling people they had fake seizures. You're not even a doctor.
drawn to.
And these are really interesting, hard to distinguish at times from a true seizure, often coexist with epilepsy.
Yeah, that's a thing that a lot of people don't realize, is that a lot of these so-called pseudo-seizures occur in patients with epilepsy that do have seizure disorder.
And rather than hear about that from us, let me play you an audio clip from a patient who I just took care of, who's in this exact situation.
I had two seizures, and then I was sent by ambulance.
And tell me, do you remember what happens when you have a seizure?
I can only hear what's going on, but I can't speak. I feel almost like I'm drowning. I get an aura beforehand, so I know I have like 10 to 15 seconds before I'm going to black out.
Describe the aura to me.
Sometimes it's a sharp pain in my head. Sometimes it's my face, like, goes completely, like, I stop talking.
And how often do you get seizures?
I get seizures almost every single day, anywhere between 4 to 15 seizures a day.
What medicine are you on right now?
I'm on Keppra twice a day.
How about today? Because you've had a couple seizures today. Have you felt confused or out of it afterwards?
No, I haven't. I feel kind of out of it for a few seconds, but then it's once I can kind of regain focus, I can talk again. Because I can hear the questions that are being asked to me, I just can't respond. The one neurologist said that they're epileptic seizures. Well, the other neurologist has said that they're psychogenic, non-epileptic seizures. I actually saw a third neurologist, and they did video recording and testing, and so if they were non-epileptic, because nothing came up on the EEG, but they still put me on Keppra. For sure today felt like a psychogenic seizure because I had really bad anxiety. I do feel that there's a difference between my seizures though when I have them. Sometimes I'll get them when I'm anxious, and anxiety medication helps. Sometimes the Keppra does help my seizures. They shorten my seizures tremendously.
So I just love that patient interview because she's so insightful. You know, does she have both going on? And she's sitting there telling me she thinks today was the psychogenic form of her seizure.
Yeah, I love that clip as well. And I totally agree that this patient is really helping you along. She's doing a lot to help you come to some sort of conclusions. And I would keep an open mind about it. I think that, you know, it's possible that she's having seizures as well as non-epileptic events as well. And certainly her doctors were considering that possibility because they were trying her on an anti-epileptic drug. But certain things in her history do suggest that it's a psychogenic rather than an actual epileptic seizure. And one of those things is that she's talking about being conscious and aware while this episode is going on. And we've discussed that generalized seizures are unconscious. And so that suggests that it's not a generalized seizure. Memory recall, being able to recall events, not typical. And other things that patients do when they're having pseudo seizures that are often telltale is they'll make what seem like purposeful movements that show that they're aware of what's going on around them. And that shouldn't be the case. They should be unconscious and unaware. And some of particularly odd movements that patients might have seen on TV or that they might be trying to, you know, simulate what they think a seizure should be looking like is very telltale, like pelvic thrusting when people are thrusting their pelvis. If they're crying and doing emotional things, you know, they're showing some sort of consciousness. Those are things that indicate maybe this isn't a real seizure.
And you may have this patient who's having these recurrent episodes of what you think are psychogenic seizures. And, you know, I generally don't like to intubate those patients if they're psychogenic seizures. You know, we want to really tease out what are those clues that this is psychogenic so we don't go down that status pathway.
So, Stuart, you've mentioned some of them.
Some other ones are if the patient holds their eyes clenched tightly shut, that tends to go more with the psychogenic than with the
true
seizures.
Because it takes a cognitive effort, right? It's something that you need to be aware to do, and that sort of falls in that category.
Patients who are arching their back or these really poorly coordinated thrashing movements, you know, it's called tonic-clonic for a reason. They're clonic rhythmic motions that tend to happen with seizures. And also, there is a difference between psychogenic seizures and malingering, or just simply kind of faking a seizure for secondary gain. You know, psychogenic seizures, these should be thought of like a conversion disorder. They're not trying to trick you. It's not volitional.
And that's a really important point, Jess, because your attitude towards these patients can make all the difference in terms of that therapeutic relationship and what eventually happens with them. These patients are not there for their own entertainment, generally speaking. They're not necessarily trying to pull one over on you, like you're saying. And they might genuinely not know what it is that's happening to them. And it could be quite distressing. And so make sure that you take that sort of non-judgmental attitude while you're working these patients up.
Pseudo-seizures is a really interesting topic. It's got a new name now, though. It's called psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, or PENIS. Yeah, PENIS. P-N-E-S. S.
Dear MRAP, the juvenile humor on the show continues to be a great disappointment to me.
What are you talking about? We didn't do the joke.
Oh. Okay.
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 P-N-E-S. It's gone through a lot of different name changes and no doubt will continue to because we're sort of struggling with exactly what it is. So many of us believe that pseudo-seizures is the patient putting it on and therefore they're trying to trick me, therefore I don't like them. So you see this a lot. If you have the diagnosis of psychogenic or panic or non-epileptic seizures, then people sort of like don't like them because they think you're trying to pull one over on them. But remember this, these are a form of conversion disorder. Often the patient has no idea that they're occurring and the physicians that are looking after the patients have to spend a lot of time trying to work out, are these real in that they need to be on medications that stop seizures or are they psychogenic and we need to go down a different path? And of course, it's incredibly complicated because there's a whole bunch of people who have seizures that are typical, that have lots of, you know, spiky spikes on their EEG that also have a number of episodes of psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. Now, the other group, the group where they're really sort of faking it for secondary gain, they're in jail and they want to go and have a nice sandwich with the nice doctor who runs the jail ER, that's a different thing. And these can be really hard. And a lot of the times, just like in this patient, they might be mixed and even the neurologists go, I really still am not sure. I think it's psychogenic, but we better put you on an anti-epileptic in case I'm wrong. Really interesting disorder. There's still so much more we need to learn about these. But if somebody comes in and says they've been given a diagnosis of pseudo-seizures, don't have that sort of first reaction, which is, oh, they're a faker. No, they're not a faker in most cases. They have a real disorder, and it might be emotional, it may be stress-related, but it's real, and so take them seriously. Be nice to them. And it is important when somebody's in the emergency department or in your urgent care clinic or wherever it is, and they're having a seizure, while you're sort of getting ready to help them and doing what you need to do, take your own pulse, step back, look at them and say, is this typical? Is it atypical? Is it one side? Is it the other side? Are there any sort of pseudo-seizure components to this? Does it look like, you know, this is a little bit volitional? That can help you down the road. You don't want to be intubating patients and giving them really powerful drugs if really what they need is something else. It can be really hard, really difficult, but if you just stop for a second, take a breath, and really look and examine the patient while they're having the seizure and you're getting ready to fix them, it can be really instructional.
Chapter 8, Summary.
So here's your summary. Here are your take-home points. Most seizures stop spontaneously, which is good, right? Except for when they don't. And then you got to freak out a little bit because any seizure lasting more than 5 minutes is pretty unlikely to stop, which means you're going to have to drop the kitchen sink of meds upon them. The initial priority when a patient is actively seizing is, of course, to protect them from physical harm and to stop the seizure. But that does not mean shoving things down their throat. Just protect them from the bumps and bruises that can occur because of the seizure and prevent them from inhaling last night's pizza by lying them on their side. Benzodiazepines through any route available. IV, IO, rectal, intraocular. Okay, not intraocular. But by any route available is the best place to start in terms of treatment. Followed by a repeat dose of benzodiazepine and then a stepwise progression to a second, third, fourth line drug. And then intubation if it's all going poopy pants. Now, if the seizure is typical for a patient with known seizures, you really don't have to do too much. But if they're not typical, you've got to think about some of the bad causes, like poisonings and brain tumors and meningitis and encephalitis. So fire up the CT scan, get ready with the LP needle, drop some antibiotics on them and some antivirals, and start treating them while you work out what the heck is going on. And don't get locked in. It's bad. It's very bad. Think about the non-neurological causes of seizures when it's not typical. Notably, think about cardiac arrhythmias and syncope. And remember that new onset seizures in patients who are pregnant or have things like AIDS or who are older, then you do all the basic stuff, but again, you've got to fire up the CT scan and start the workup and get a consult because this is not typical and therefore it could be something bad. So again, let me summarize. Most seizures are fine, they're short-lived and easy to treat, except when they're not. Okay? Is that simple enough for you?
I got it. I'm ready.
Okay, do it. What the hell does PML stand for?
Polyleukoencephalopathy.
Progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy.
Okay. Yeah. The coagulable state they're in, you know, when we were made to... Well, I'm going to talk about how when God made us. When God made you...
And finally, and yes, we have saved it for last, we are going to talk about penis. That's psychogenic, non-epileptic seizures.
You just said penis.
Penis. I said penis.
Okay.
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 And but rather than falling apart.
Speaking
here.
Of penis.
Dear Emrah, I thought you said there was going to be no humor like this in the show.